12 feet from the boy, and none made a move. The bobsleds were whooshing and scraping again, and you could hear a ruffle of applause out in some cold, open country. God knew where. Conrad got up from his metal stool, impelled by something he could no longer reason with, not even with the help of Epictetus. A rushing sound rose inside his skull until he couldn't hear the television set or anything else. The faces of the Nordic Bund and Nuestra Familia stared at him as he walked between their two turfs. 5-0 gave him such an uncomprehending, wide-eyed look. He knew what was going through his mind.
"Mycelli! He going crazy!"
When Conrad reached Pocahontas' side, he thought at first the boy was dead. He was sprawled, chest down, but his head and neck were twisted at an odd angle. He appeared to be trying to look at the ceiling, but his eyes were focusing on nothing at all, and his mouth was wide open, as if he had just taken his last breath. A mold, a fungus, spreading over his skin. But, in fact, it was only a faint reddish-white stubble that had begun to grow not only on his face, but also on his skull, where he had shaved it. Conrad knelt down and started to speak to him. Didn't even know his name. Couldn't very well call him Pocahontas. He touched the boy's shoulder and said, "Can you hear me?" No reply. Conrad put his fingertips on the boy's neck and could feel a pulse in his throat. Now he became aware of the stench that arose from his body. Terrified of the shower room, Pocahontas probably hadn't bathed since he arrived at Santa Rita. His legs were twisted and spread out in such a way that it looked as if he must have been running when he fell. Between his legs, in the folds of the yellow felony pajamas, barely visible because of the grotesque sprocketing of his legs, you could see a long red stain, about 2 inches wide. Conrad put his hand back on the boy's shoulder and said, "Don't try to move. We're going to get you some help." Still on one knee, he looked about beseechingly at his fellow inmates, these yellow figures frozen in their zones. He picked out 5-0 with his eyes. "Get a deputy. This guy's bleeding." 5-0 tucked his chin down and arched his eyebrows, as if he had just been presented with a completely irrational proposition. Conrad looked all around the pod, craning his head wildly. The video camera. He spotted the surveillance camera up near the ceiling line at Vasily's end of the pod room. He stood up and stepped farther out toward the center of the floor, directly in the line of the camera lens. He stared right into it and raised both hands in supplication and yelled out, "Yo! Deputy!" In the very instant it left his lips, it occurred to him that he had never uttered the cry, "Yo!" before. But this was Santa Rita. "We got a man injured in here!" He started pointing toward Pocahontas, all the while keeping his eyes pinned on the camera. "He's bleeding! Yo! Deputy! We got a man here's bleeding!" In no time, two deputies, Armantrout and the younger, leaner one who had clamped the Michael Jackson love glove on Mutt, materialized.
"What the hell happened to him?"
said Armantrout, leaning over and peering down at Pocahontas. Conrad paused. He was keenly aware that the entire pod was hanging on every word. "I don't know," he said finally. "He was standing here. And then he collapsed." To himself he said, "I've gone this far. Why don't I tell them the whole story?" But he didn't. And now the nurse, Maggie, was kneeling beside Pocahontas. This much-mocked maggot was, in fact, a rather sweet, plump woman, about 40. Conrad had never seen her up close before, and he was surprised. Not even her mannish uniform, the white blouse, pants, and flat white shoes, could detract from her complexion, which was so smooth and milky white, or her hair, which was a reddish gold and pulled back into an elaborate plaited bun. She leaned down close to Pocahontas's face and began talking to him softly. Presently the boy's eyes focused on hers, and he murmured something. Armantrout stepped over Pocahontas's body, so that he had one foot planted on either side of his waist, and he bent down and hooked his hands under his shoulders and picked him up. In Armantrout's powerful grip, his frail form came up off the floor like a plastic doll's. His fungoid head, with its auburn plume flopping to one side, lolled forward on his neck, a long pale stem that seemed ready to snap off from the weight of the grotesque noggin it supported. Pocahontas's legs did a helpless half-shuffle as the two deputies led him off with his arms hooked over their shoulders. The blood stain was now plainly visible. It extended from the seat 4 or 5 inches down the inside of one leg of his pants. Before the nurse, Maggot, left, walking behind them, she turned and gave Conrad a look. It wasn't exactly a smile. It was a look of such warmth. He couldn't think of her as Maggot. He wanted to embrace her. He wanted to hold her and put his cheek next to hers. No woman had given him a look like that since... He couldn't even bring himself to think about it. And precisely why he wanted to hold this woman he couldn't have explained in 1,000 years. He was now standing by himself in the spot where Pocahontas had fallen, aware that he was now what he had certainly never wanted to be, the center of attention of the entire pod. He could hear the television set once more as it droned away up on top of the metal stanchion in the black zone. The commentator with the TV sports voice was speaking, but no longer in hushed tones.
"Al Westerfield, captain of the U.S. bobsledding team, the champions, winners in the finals of the European Winter Games here in Vogelsbein, Austria. Congratulations, Al."
Out of breath, "Thank you, Sam."
"Al, that was a stupendous victory, the first championship for a U.S. bobsledding team in these games in, what is it now, almost 2 decades. But it was terribly close."
Still out of breath, but obviously elated.
"Too close for comfort, Sam. Frankly, for a second there, I thought you'd lost it on that third turn."
Taking a big gulp of air.
"I did too, Sam. It was my fault. I overcompensated and we almost came up over the lip," panting. "But then when I snapped back, it gave us like a little kick in the butt, and I think maybe we even picked up a fraction of a second."
"Sounds like a mighty big kick in the butt, Al. Maybe the biggest kick in the butt in these games so far. Al Westerfield, captain of the victorious American bobsledders."
As Conrad walked back toward his table, he perceived, it registered first as a sensory perception rather than a thought, that no one was looking at him. Both the Nordic Bund and Nuestra Familia seemed to pull back rather than risk contact with this pariah. He caught just a glimpse of 5-0's wide, putty-colored face. For an instant, 5-0 shrugged his eyebrows upward in the look that asks, "What can I tell you?" before turning away and leaning toward Flacco, as if he had something important to tell him. Back at the metal table, sitting on the metal stool, Conrad couldn't even make himself pretend to look at the pages of the Stoics. He sat bolt upright, looking straight ahead at nothing, at the shadow of the recesses of the shower room behind the retaining wall. His heart was pounding. His armpits were abloom with heat. He was churning with fear, anger, and guilt. He was now the lone white new fish in the pod, young, slightly built, and all at once highly visible, and scorned and held in contempt. Not only had he come to the aid of an untouchable, a poor, ravaged, humiliated, turned-out, freakish homosexual, a punk, he had also come close to being a snitch. Rotto and his crew had barely departed the shower area when he was out in the middle of the pod room screaming, "Yo, deputy!" and calling the hacks to the scene of the crime. "Yes." And which one of these paragons of manhood? Who on the black turf? Who on the Latin turf? Who on the white turf? With their tattoos and crosses and gorged muscles, had the courage or the simple human decency to help a poor pathetic kid like Pocahontas? None of them. Not one. What kind of manhood was it to look the other way and not snitch when a brute decides to have his way with the hide of another human being? Yes. And what about himself? He had come to Pocahontas's aid, all right. When it was altogether too late? Why had he never offered him the hand of, if not friendship, comradeship? Why had he let him flounder in this gray concrete hole, totally isolated, totally without the simplest word of encouragement or counsel? Why had he... Or was he being too hard on himself? What chance had the boy ever had from the very beginning? Pocahontas had turned himself into a freak. He had shaved his own head, shaved his own eyebrows, grown his own mohawk plume, punctured his own earlobes and rims, and studded them with earrings, slumped himself over with a slacker's posture, screamed to the world with his own sick, perverse defiance, "Look at me! I'm a freak, and I'm glad of it!" Epictetus' words resounded in his mind. "You are not born to share humiliation or evil fortune. If a man is unfortunate, remember that his misfortune is his own fault. We ought not to spend our feelings on things beyond our power." So agitated was he that now all of it, his fear, his anger, and his guilt, was suddenly directed toward Epictetus. What would the great master have him do? Simply turn away, avert his eyes like the others? Like the Mexicans, like Five-O, like Pops in his shuffle, like Vastly for that matter, and do nothing? Was this newly found god of his, Zeus, a false god? And Epictetus a false teacher? If that was so, then he had nothing. No one left and nothing to draw upon. Not even that little spark of divinity upon which only this morning he had based every last tiny hope that still existed for his miserable life. Suddenly, a wave of purest guilt. What was he doing? Under the pressure of the very first test sent by Zeus, he was buckling, abandoning his faith. "It is for you, then," Epictetus had written, "to say, 'Zeus, send me what trial thou wilt. For I have endowments and resources given me by thee to bring myself honor through what befalls.'" But no, he then scolded. "Instead of that, you sit trembling for fear of what may happen, or lamenting, mourning, and groaning for what does happen, and then you reproach the gods. What else but impiety indeed can attend upon so ignoble a spirit as yours?" Impiety. His very first test, and already he was doubting the power of Zeus. He felt ashamed. He was denying not only Zeus, but the existence of his own soul. "What are you, slave?" Epictetus had demanded, "but a soul carrying a corpse and a quart of blood? What was this body of his, which he was so worried about, but a corpse and a quart of blood? The living part of him was his soul, and his soul was nothing other than the spark of Zeus." Still sitting bolt upright, he put both hands, palms down, on the pages of the Stoics and closed his eyes. He knew they would all be looking at him, the entire pod, but so what? He rejected the pod's code of false manliness. He kept his eyes closed and banished them, all of them, from his central nervous system, them and all their yammering and motherfuckin' and inane TV shows. He opened up his mind, his heart, his connective tissue, the pores of his skin, the coupling of his joints, the very marrow of his bones. He emptied his body, that corpse with its quart of blood, of all sensations. He became a vessel yearning only to receive the divine. So profound was this state, this trance, that he had no idea how long he had been in it, when something, he had no idea what, caused him to open his eyes. The ambient sounds of the pod room, the burble of voices, had dropped off all over again. But in the corner of his eye, he saw him. Rotto was coming straight toward him. Consciously, he wanted to look away, but something made him stare right into the brute's face. "Zeus, send me what trial thou wilt." Rotto looked enormous. There were deep shadows in his yellow felony pajama top shirt beneath the slabs of muscle on his chest. The hair on the sides of his head was so greasy it reflected the overhead light. The shot collar. Conrad looked about for 5-0, not because he thought his Sally would ever step in and help him in some way, but because he was his last comrade, his last tie to the earthly beings from whom men are used to deriving their courage and support. And there he was, 5-0, with his smooth, flat face and his shock of black hair, about 30 feet away, standing there with his Latino buddies looking on, waiting for the confrontation, for the beano, like everybody else. And now the brute was standing over him, looking down. His eyebrows were lifted, and he had a small, indecipherable smile on his face. Conrad fastened on the most insignificant thing, the milky, slightly yellowish cast of the whites of Rotto's eyes. A deep voice with a soft and obscenely friendly lilt.
"Hey, dude. Mind if I sit down?"
Conrad had no idea what to do. The entire pod was watching this little set to. He could not afford to be like Pocahontas and do nothing. But do what? The next thing he knew, Rotto was sitting on the metal stool next to his and leaning over with his elbows on the table and cocking his head and looking directly into Conrad's eyes, just as he had with Pocahontas.
"So, how you doing, Conrad?"
The same soft, deep, insinuatingly friendly tone. Conrad's mind spun, desperately searching for a strategy. Epictetus, what had he said? The trial had begun. What was he supposed to do? A soft, almost sugary voice.
"So, this your first time being down, Conrad?"
Groaned Rotto, in an unctuously sympathetic way.
"I know that trip. I know that trip."
He looked away and shook his head as if tormented by the memory of it. Then he turned back and leaned even closer to Conrad, until his face and his milky eyes and his hideously benign smile were barely a foot away. And he said,
"Any of these motherfuckers trying to sweat you?"
Conrad kept staring at him, his mind racing. "Treating me just like he did Pocahontas, and I'm transfixed just like Pocahontas, by the snake. Act. Do something. Now. But what?" 5-0 had said, "Use the mouth."
"Tell you what," said Rotto, with an exaggerated croon. "You want to make a phone call out of here? You want to call home? You want to make a phone call right now? I made an arrangement with those motherfuckers."
He motioned toward the black turf with his head.
"They opening up those phones for me and my buddies."
Just what he did with Pocahontas.
"Ain't no damn shuck, dude. Take you over right now. Talk long as you want. Tell you one thing. Take care of one thing real fast. Show all these motherfuckers you got somebody on your side. Ain't one of 'em gonna run no damn game on you after—"
Suddenly, before he was even conscious of his own will, Conrad sprang to his feet and looked down at Rotto with a furious expression on his face. Startled, Rotto recoiled and slid back on the stool, and half staggered to his feet. His insinuating smile had vanished.
"Hey, brother, look," Conrad said with a rasp deep in his throat. "You a number in here, and I'm a number in here, see?"
He was only halfway aware of what was happening to his accent.
"And I ain't trying to disrespect you none, see? All I wants is to do my time. I ain't trying to sweat you none, play you none, dog you none, or get over on you none. I ain't doing nothing but setting here trying to read my book and write a letter to my wife and my children. You understand what I'm saying? So ain't no cause for nobody to be playing me or dogging me or running a game on me neither."
Rotto's expression was one of blank incomprehension. The man was baffled. This gave Conrad courage, and at the same time the word fox popped into his mind. The fox, the craven, godforsaken beast of mischievousness and deceit, said Epictetus. That was what he was trying to be, the fox. But it was too late to turn back. The borrowed soul of the Chinese trustee, who had learned to talk blacker than the homiest East Oakland homeboy, swelled up in his voice box.
"I ain't asking you for no favors, see? I don't want no damn telephone. I don't want no damn TV. All's I wants is what I already got. You know what I'm saying? I mean, brother, you can have your telephone, and you can have your TV, and you can have this whole damn pod, and this whole damn jailhouse, and this whole damn Alameda County, and this whole damn East Bay, and that's cool. That's cool. 'Cause all I'm asking is, let me serve my own damn time. Let me eat my own damn clock. See?
So why don't you kindly do the right thing, brother? And I'll go my way, and you go with God. And you and me's hello, so long, goodbye. Nice knowing you. And everything's cool."
Rotto's baffled expression now changed to a puzzled scowl. A ditch ran down his forehead, between his eyebrows, making him look extremely angry. But then he forced a smile onto his face and laughed with a snort that shook his whole torso. The laugh ceased abruptly, although he kept the smile on.
"That's nice," he said in a low baritone. "Fact, that's real good." "Yeah. Fact, that's real cute."
He forced out another snorting laugh.
"You're a cute little dude, Conrad."
With that, he brought his right hand up and seized Conrad's left cheek between his thumb and forefinger and shook it, as if in a playful tweak. Conrad felt a dreadful fear, and then a terrible rage.
"We cannot be free from fear, we cannot be free from anxiety. Yet we say, O Lord Zeus, how am I to be rid of anxiety?"
"Fool, have you no hands? Did not Zeus make them for you? Has he not given you greatness of mind? Has he not given you manliness? When you have these strong hands to help you? My hands." In that instant, a fiery energy. With his left hand, he seized Rotto's right hand and wrenched it off his cheek. Immediately he sensed that his grip enclosed all four of Rotto's knuckles. For all his massive shoulders, arms, and chest, the brute's hands were not big. Conrad's, product of the suicidal freezer unit, and of Zeus, were bigger and more powerful. "When you have these strong hands to help you," he brought up his other hand, and now both his hands had the brute's knuckles in a crushing vice. He felt himself possessed of a superhuman strength. Hercules, he who cleansed the world of unjust and brutal men. Rotto's face quivered from the pain. He groped for Conrad's throat with his other hand, but the pain was too much. His right hand was being crushed. He lowered his left to try to pry Conrad's fingers off. Too late. Conrad was now an engine devoted solely to closing the vice. The muscles of his chest, his back, his abdominals were contracted to their very limits at the service of his hands. Rotto's knuckles and the metacarpal bones,
He willed their destruction. Willed it.
Willed it!
An audible snap.
Ah!
A groan, very nearly a howl, rose from deep inside the brute. His eyes closed, and his face became terribly contorted. He kept clawing at Conrad's hand, but now Conrad forced his wrist over backward. The brute had no choice but to try to shift his weight, to get out from under the fierce torque.
Oh! 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 Oh!
The moans were coming out in spurts. Rotto couldn't get his breath. For Conrad, life, existence, consciousness, had but one purpose. Cleanse the world of an unjust and brutal man. The very words themselves, from Zeus, fastened upon his mind. He could see his own forearms swelling with the stupendous exertion. He could feel the brute's bony processes collapsing inside his grip. He forced the forearm backward, against the natural rotation of the elbow. All at once Rotto lost his footing. He went down on one knee. His head went back. His eyes were closed. A hideous grimace was on his face. Snap!
Ah!
A scream. A full-fledged scream, the sort of scream that breaks loose once all defenses are gone. Rotto collapsed. He fell over on one side, then flopped on his back. Conrad was on top of him, a terrier who won't let go. He could feel the fight going out of Rotto's wrist. So he forced it backward, 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 backward. Snap!
Ah!
Another scream, followed by a huge, tearful sigh. Rotto was staring at him in a cockeyed way, breathing rapidly, with little heaves. But his eyes weren't focusing. His ponytail stuck out on one side on the floor. It looked filthy. His face had the stricken slackness of defeat. Only then did Conrad hear the ruckus, the shouts.
"Get him, Rotto! Whack that sucker! Off that little motherfucker! Get up, man!"
They were all around him, the entire pod, Vasily's gang, the Latinos, the Chinese druggies, Rotto's Nordic Bund, the whole bunch. Out of the corner of his eye, Conrad was aware of the wraith-like rapmaster MC New York with his green do-rag, Vasily with his cornrows and paper ribbons, and 5-0, who stared in wonderment, his eyes big as quarters. They wanted more. More thrashing. Looser teeth. Blood. Bone fragments. Rotto's boys obviously thought their champion, their shot-caller, was going to rise up off the floor and teach this insignificant fish the most terrible lesson of his life. They weren't jumping in, because why would Rotto ever need help against anyone so puny? They didn't know he was already out of it. Finished. Shut down for the night. Conrad lifted himself to a sitting position, straddling Rotto's midsection. He relaxed his grip on the brute's hand. Slowly, staring at him in a strangely distracted way, going, Rotto lifted his huge left arm. For an instant, Conrad thought he was going after his throat again. But then the arm collapsed, fell, and flopped down on the other arm, as if to protect it from further damage. Conrad let go of the brute's hand and rocked back on his heels. He looked up at Rotto's boys, fearing the worst. But they were stunned. Slack-jawed, they too stared, but not at Conrad. They stared at Rotto's right hand. The wrist was twisted about like a rope. The knuckles were no longer in a straight line. The flesh of the back of the hand was hideously swollen. His face bore a look of such agony. The crowd grew quiet. An unbelievable truth was dawning. The champion, the mighty shot caller, had just been vanquished by a new fish half his size. A ripple ran through the crowd. Heads began turning toward the entry to the pod room. Conrad felt a grip on his shoulder. He swung his head about. It was 5-0 leaning down toward him.
"Hey, brother, get up! Bag it!"
He nodded toward the entrance.
"Deputies, ma'am."
To his amazement, he didn't think 5-0 would dare help him in front of Rado's boys. 5-0 hooked his hands under his shoulders and gave him a hoist up and steered him back into a cluster of Nuestra Familia Latinos. Otherwise, the yellow felony pajamas were moving this way and that, heading for their racial turfs, as if it were the beginning of pod time.
"You! You yo-yos!" Armantrout bellowed. "What's this clusterfuck all about?"
Breathing rapidly, dazed by what had just happened, Conrad stood with 5-0 and a group of Latinos in the white section of the pod room. Armantrout led 4 gray-shirted deputies wielding batons, looking this way and that. There, in the middle of the white section, on the concrete floor, lay a single white figure in yellow felony pajamas, rolled over on his side and moaning. That there was a wounded inmate, even a grievously wounded inmate, lying on the floor, would not have surprised the deputies. But when they realized who it was, they were dumbstruck.
Rado, the white shot caller.
For a moment, Armantrout stared at Vastly, who was facing the other way, the usual simple-minded look of jailhouse insouciance on his mug. He stared at Rado's boys in the center of the white turf. You could hear a low rumble of mutterings and grousing. They were glowering at Conrad, a fact that did not even register on the deputies, since he would have been one of the last inmates they would have suspected of having done in the mighty Rado. Then Armantrout looked down at Rado.
"Jesus Christ, what's going on in this shithole tonight?"
The brute was still gasping for breath and moaning. His eyes were shut, and his face was twisted.
"Can you get up?"
Shit. Armantrout looked about at his men.
"Hey, Reese, better go get Jerry's kid."
Jerry's kid was the prison doctor, who had a withered left arm and leg, and reminded them of the afflicted children on the annual Jerry Lewis television program in behalf of muscular dystrophy sufferers. Then he announced to the inmates in his huge voice,
"All right, pod time's over. Line up. You're going back to the cells. You guys want to clusterfuck, you can clusterfuck over the wire."
He looked at Riffraff.
"All right, you guys line up first."
He looked at Wino.
"And then you guys."
He looked at Vastly and Rapmaster MC New York.
"And then you guys. Anybody starts any more bullshit gets a vacation in the rubber room."
Back in the cell, as they waited for lights out, 5-0 was beside himself. He was acting as if he had been in Conrad's corner the whole time during the fight with Rado, urging him on to victory.
"Hey, brah, you win bus up that bugger, yeah? Bus him up!"
He said it in a hoarse whisper.
"The whole pod, brah, the whole pod, they went spuck."
They watched.
"That big moke."
That big tough guy.
"Sit down with one new fish, you brah."
"Sit down with a new fish, you brother."
"And then he went make eyes that kind. And then he went say, get chance, baby, get chance, that kind."
"And then he kind of made eyes at you, and as much as said, you want to get it on, baby?"
"And all them buggers, they went think, so you going make ass, and Rado, he going treat you like one mahu."
"And everybody thought you were going to screw up, and he was going to treat you like a faggot."
"But then, unreal, brah, no more polite little howly. You when used the mouth, and then you when used the heart, and then you when broke up that bugger."
"But then, unreal, brother, you stopped being the polite little white boy. You used the mouth, and then you used the heart, and then you beat up that bugger." 5-0 was trembling, quivering with joy at the triumph of his celly, like a fan whose idol had just won the fight for the championship. And yet his voice never rose above that excited whisper. Ever the realist, he was looking ahead. Sound carried over the wire in the pod at Santa Rita, and he didn't want it known that he was the cheering partisan of the new fish who had humiliated Rotto.
"Oh, brother,"
he said, shaking his head and looking at the wall. His whisper was lower than ever.
"This one beef to the max, Conrad. That big moke, he da shot collar."
"Don't worry," said Conrad. "Everybody saw what happened. He started it. He grabbed me by the cheek. I had to do something."
"They went spark, yeah?"
"Yeah, they saw it."
"But then you went broke up that bugger."
5-0 put his head down. When he finally lifted it, he looked Conrad in the eye and said softly,
"They try for kill you."
Conrad just looked at him. 5-0 shook his head, yes.
"Make die dead, Conrad."
Conrad smiled slightly. Exactly why, he couldn't have begun to say.
"They try for kill you."
It seemed like an oddly abstract concept. "I can't believe any of this is happening, 5-0. I keep thinking I'm going to wake up and be somewhere else."
"I know, brah," said 5-0. "From long time, I want one time out. Yo, deputy, time out kind. Pull the plug and think about no more nothing and do the time like that. This place stay funny kind."
"This place would be kind of funny."
"If only they let you take a break every now then."
When lights out came, Conrad climbed up to the top bunk and stretched out on his back. It was much too hot in here, and his heart was beating much too fast, and he knew he would never go to sleep. But he would need to rest before... he couldn't even imagine what might happen tomorrow in the pod room. He stared up through the lizard screen and listened to the ceiling fans struggling and the catwalk creaking as a deputy walked along overhead. Soon, over the wire, the nocturnal yammering had begun. The J-Cat, the one who was obsessed with Hank Aaron in a yellow wool suit, began moaning for his medication.
"Meds! Meds! Meds! Meds!"
A voice from somewhere.
"Oh, shit, here we go again. The fuck, giving the man his shuffle pills. Where's that maggot at? Yo, maggot! Emergency med call, maggot. Code blue, name of Hensley."
It was an oaky voice, a high-pitched play-acting voice. Conrad felt a burning sensation inside his skull. So, now it began.
"Motherfucker don't need no pills," said another voice. "Motherfucker needs a motherfucking shower, is what the fuck he needs. Motherfucker, he be too funky. Smell like the motherfucker's dying. You a disgrace to the brothers, motherfucker."
"But they told me," said the J-Cat. "Told me I was gonna die if I go outside my house."
"Hensley! Hensley!" said the oaky voice. "Do you copy? Do you copy?"
From the bunk below, 5-0 whispered.
"Hey, brah, you in hear him?"
"Yeah, I heard him, 5-0.
"Hensley, stick your ass out your porthole so's we can see you. Then you ass out."
The next thing Conrad knew, 5-0 was off his bunk and standing up and looking at him and pointing in the gloom toward the catwalk.
"Maybe they put you in the rubber room, Conrad.
Maybe they put you in the B-pod."
"What do you mean?"
"Act crazy, kind man. Like mutt. Yell crazy things. Kick the door. Go J-Cat like that. And then the deputies, they going take you out of here."
"I wouldn't even consider it," said Conrad. "I..." But he stopped. He wanted to say,
"I want to keep my character.
Why did I fight Rotto? Because I refuse to be dishonored. Outside this hole, this pigsty, no one will ever know that I lived as a man and fought like a man and refused to sell myself at any price. But in this grim little universe, the pod, the only world that is left,
they will know, and Zeus will know, and I, a son of Zeus, will know.
But they going kill you, brah. Make die dead.
This bit of clay, you mean, Five-O? They'll do what they have to do, and I'll do what I have to do. Besides, when did I ever say I was immortal? For several seconds, Five-O didn't say anything. Then he sighed and said,
"Either you get plenty lakas.
Either you have big balls.
Or you going crazy like mutt.
Dis bit of clay, yeah?
Don't go crazy on me, Conrad. Every celly going crazy. Bummers, man."
Tucka, 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 tucka. The ice cream cup bongo percussion had begun. And then the slaps against the sides of the bunks. And then the voice of Dinky Man.
"And now, direct from the Apollo Theater in New York City, Rapmaster MC New York!"
Conrad didn't know if it was his imagination or what, but the cheers that followed seemed like brutal cries, and a strange, mad ululation spread throughout the pod as Beatbox thrummed his a cappella electric bass. Rapmaster MC New York, Conrad could see his bony, ravaged visage and his pirate's do-rag, began as he always did.
"Yo, sugar. Think that's a ruby you got stuck inside your crack?"
But this time the great moan over the wire rose immediately to something just short of a scream in a cry for blood. And throughout the first stanza it never let up. And the chorus, "Give it up, bitch! Give it up, bitch!" burst forth with a fury, then quickly died down and was supplanted by a whinnying sound, as if the inmates just knew what was coming next, and could barely restrain themselves long enough to actually hear it. Some more a cappella strumming by Beat Boy, and then Rapmaster MC New York resumed.
"Little punk, he gon' get turned out. He gon' learn about coming through. For the real funk, he be ass out. Ram at sucker, he gon' pass out. Fucker, he gon' switch from him to her. That jism sucker won't know which, and ain't that rich."
The inmates didn't even wait for the Rapmaster. With a laughing roar, they broke into the refrain. The very air of the pod exploded with, "Give it up, bitch! Give it up, bitch! Give it up, bitch! Give it up, bitch!" Conrad lay there with his heart racing. Then he closed his eyes and tried to visualize Carl and Christy and Jill. All that remained to him outside this doomed universe of men who had reduced themselves to the level of the bodies they shared with the animals.
Carl. Christy. He could no longer see them at all, couldn't bring their features into focus. Just a couple of tiny ghosts with little coronas of blonde hair. Jill. He couldn't see the beautiful Jill he had fallen in love with. He couldn't see that face. Instead, he saw a knit brow, an angry brow. He saw her body and tried to feel his love for her. And instead he merely saw the flesh. Nevertheless, he reckoned, as his heart banged away and the ceiling fans scracked, scracked, and scracked overhead, and the bloody ululations resounded over the wire, it was through that flesh that he had transmitted the spark of Zeus to Carl and Christy. He tried once more to visualize Carl, and he couldn't. And tears came to his eyes. One day Carl would be a man, and long before that time, he would need someone to tell him what a man was. He rolled over and lowered his head below the edge of his bunk and said,
"Five-O."
"Yeah, brudda?"
"Promise me one thing."
"What's that, brudda?"
"Whatever happens tomorrow, you'll write it all down and send it to my wife."
"Write it down?"
"Yeah.
Write everything down."
"Will you promise me that?"
"Start with what happened tonight, with Rado coming over and everything."
"I want my son to know, Five-O. I want him to know I didn't lie here trembling and moaning and groaning and whining and—"
"It's important, Five-O."
"Will you promise me that much?"
Yeah, I promise, brother. But remember, cool head, main thing. Don't go crazy on me. You promise me that.
Don't worry. I'm not going crazy. I've never been clearer about anything in my life.
He rolled over once more onto his back. His heart continued to race, but he could feel the tension begin to recede from his knees, his thighs, his abdomen, his arms, his shoulders, his neck. And then even his heart began to calm down. Breathing deeply and rhythmically, he tried to imagine his very self opening, opening, opening up. His pores, the very fibers of his muscles, his nerve endings, the chambers of his heart and lungs, his solar plexus. An energy seemed to spread out in a single wave from his heart to the tender flesh beneath the nails of his fingers and toes, and to the rims of his ears, and the flesh on his scalp. And he was sure that he saw a bright light behind his eyelids.
Zeus, send me what trial thou wilt.
He hadn't meant for it to be audible, but it came out as a hoarse whisper. From below, Five-O whispered back,
"Hey, brother, you don't go crazy on me. You promise me that."
Chapter 20 Mai's Army. Scrack, 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 scrack. The belt-driven turbines were struggling away up in the roof, to no avail. The pod remained hot and airless, despite the fact that it was now, what, 1 a.m., 2 a.m.? As Conrad lay there on his bunk, staring up through the lizard screen above his head, the ambient light from the catwalk created huge silhouettes that gave the darkness a delirious quality.
Roar!
Somebody flushed a toilet. Glug, 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 glug. Oh, man, somebody protested. Half a dozen inmates were snoring so loudly, with such helpless surrender, you could feel their exhaustion. Every mindless rattle of it came croaking in over the wire. But they were fortunate, weren't they? They could sleep. Rotto's crew could sleep. Rotto, wherever he was, could sleep. They could store up energy for the assault, however it might come. They were not lying here with their hearts played out, ratcheting, drained by the constant alert, 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 alert. Conrad was so hot, he had a slick of oily sweat where the underside of his upper arm lay against his ribcage, and another where the underside of his chin met his neck. He had finally taken off his felony pajamas and was wearing only his shorts, like 5-0, down below, and practically every other inmate, even though he didn't want to be that naked if the onslaught began. Not that there was any way they could break into a cell in the middle of the night. Or was there? The ingenuity of the brutes, who made mirrors out of ice cream cups and daggers out of book covers, their perverse power of invention knew no bounds. He had never felt so utterly depleted. He was dying to sink into the oblivion of sleep. He would start to sink, 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 sink. And then the sentinel, somewhere deep in his brain, would jerk him back into consciousness. Sweat was collecting in his eyebrows, his mustache, and the stubble of his beard, which had an irritable feel to it, like a rash. Absent-mindedly, he pressed his mustache on either side with his thumb and forefinger, as if to wring the moisture out. It made him think of the freezer unit, the way his mustache used to freeze and sparkle. 0 degrees Fahrenheit. He closed his eyes, immersed himself in that frigid zinc-gray box. An upper slot, L-17, trying to rock a huge carton of frozen pork loins loose, and the breath fog was coming out in spurts, and Dom was looking at Kenny and saying,
I got good news and bad news. And...
What?
He jerked himself alert. His heart was hammering away. He was sweating profusely. Yet the pod was as quiet as before. He tried to think of Carl and Christy. And Jill. She would care. She wouldn't disappear. She would come back to him. He closed his eyes. The duet. He was in the sad little living room. No, he was out in the garage. The door was up. A slim, young figure. But it was not Jill. It was the Leela Slo. Wild, teased hair, heavy eye makeup, almost like a burglar's mask. A sleeveless black T-shirt, with such big, loose armholes, he could see the sides of her little breasts. She came toward him, smiling. She pressed her little breasts against his bare chest. Thump, 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 thump. He came to with a start. He rolled over on his abdomen and stared down at the floor of the cell. Someone was battering the floor from underneath with the upright end of a broom, a mop, a pole. Thump, 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 thump. But there was no room, no cellar space, no foundation under the floor, which was a slab built flat upon the ground. Rotto's crew, they had tunneled under the ground, coming up through the floor. Thump, 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 thump. The entire bunk began to rock, end to end, the long way. The battering beneath the cell grew louder. All at once, no more light from the catwalk. Instead, the flash of a bright moon through a clerestory window which was swaying. The screeching of the ceiling turbines ceased at the same instant, and a colossal creaking, groaning sound commenced, as if some prodigious force were trying to jimmy the catwalk off the wall, pry the metal bunks apart, pull the nails out of the timbers, wrench the water pipes out of the toilets, and then the cries began.
"The fuck, motherfucker! Dinky Man, where you at? Yo, deputy, I don't play this shit! Yo, Armantrout, the lights!
The fuck, you feel that?
Mira! Terremoto!
Motherfucker! Motherfucker! Motherfucker!"
The bunk was bucking back and forth and groaning at the joints. Conrad grabbed the end of the bunk ladder that stuck up by his head and held on to keep from falling off. He heard a thud on the floor. He looked down. It was 5-0, who had been thrown out of his bunk.
"Hey, Conrad! What's the haps?"
"I don't know." But then he could feel the bunk pitching and rolling in S-waves.
"Earthquake! Bombers, man!"
5-0 tried to stand up and was immediately thrown down to the floor again. Afraid of being thrown from the upper bunk, Conrad gripped the ladder uprights and swung himself down the side and dropped to the floor. He lost his footing and almost hit his head on the rim of the toilet. The very concrete of the floor seemed to be rolling. Conrad and 5-0 were on all fours. The sweaty sheen of 5-0's back reflected a pale phosphorescent light from the clerestory window above. Conrad looked up. The lizard wire itself appeared to be dipping and swaying. 5-0 shouted,
"Hey, deputy! Open the door, you!"
Similar cries were coming from all over the pod. Rats trapped in their cages, the inmates were desperate to flee to open ground. Amid all the lurching, bucking, pitching, rolling, yawing, groaning, and swaying, there arose a tremendous cracking sound overhead. Something had blotted out the moonlight in the clerestory window. It was the catwalk, which had come loose from the wall. A beam of light shot out at a crazy angle. A deputy with a flashlight.
"Yo! Fry, where you at?"
Conrad struggled to his feet, lurched toward the bunk ladder, held on, turned to 5-0, and held out his hand.
"Get up! Grab hold! The catwalk's coming loose! We gotta get under here!"
With his head, he indicated the space between the upper and lower bunks. 5-0 grabbed his arm, and the two of them piled onto the lower bunk. The bunk's metal frame was swaying. It sounded as if the wall was cracking in the corner. A pungent smell filled the atmosphere,
oddly sweet and yet rotten. Dust. As the hulk of Santa Rita began coming apart, and the accumulated filth of half a century burst forth and filled the mouths, the noses, the lungs of the trapped rats, who gulped for air. Suddenly, a force so great, both men were thrown against the wall, 5-0 on top of Conrad. The lower bunk rose beneath them and pitched them head first. A tremendous roar. Huge masses gave way. The sound of wood, metal, glass, concrete falling and smashing the bunk frame. The floor heaved up at an angle, and Conrad felt himself drop head down into... what? Utter blackness. Buried. Suffocating. His hips were somewhere above his head. His torso was wedged between... what? He could see... nothing. His left arm was free. He groped wildly. He tried to reach up. Impossible. A mass of incalculable weight pressed down on him. He reached back. Flesh! 5-0! The effort of calling out made him cough. The dust! He was choking on it.
Conrad! Brada!
A feeble voice, and then he felt a grip on his leg.
Brada! Brada! Brada!
5-0's voice had become a high, frantic peep. The terrified voice and desperate grip sent a new wave of claustrophobia through Conrad. Buried in utter darkness. A tomb. He was hyperventilating, and the harder his lungs worked, the more dust they drew in. Choking. Dying. And yet he was getting air from somewhere. He could hear moans, shrieks, piteous cries from all over the pod. He reached down. An empty space.
What? A pit?
He prayed, although he couldn't have called it prayer, in the words of Epictetus. Lead me, O Zeus, and thou my destiny.
Brother! Brother! Brother!
5-0 was whimpering, crying, clinging desperately to his leg.
Shut up, 5-0! Save your breath!
The primal urge, to protect, gave him strength. He wriggled his head, shoulders, and chest down into the hole. The pit, the space, whatever it was. The earth had stopped moving. Screams from all over.
Yo! Help me! The fuck! Help me! Ah, motherfucker! Ah!
You could hear someone bleating.
Meds! Meds! Meds!
It was the voice of the J-Cat.
No, leave me, brother.
I'm not leaving you. Let go my leg and follow me. Obediently, 5-0 let go. Conrad slithered all the way down into the space below. 5-0 scrambled behind him. They were on their bellies, struggling for breath. Pitch black. Conrad tried to lift his head, but an immense, jagged mass weighed down from above. Choking, he slithered forward.
Lace. He could see it. Faint pinpoints of light.
He slithered forward some more. It was a pale light coming through a tangle of debris up ahead. They were inside some sort of crevice, no more than a foot high and barely the width of their shoulders. Conrad felt a terrific grip on his leg. 5-0 was gasping and moaning.
Help me, brother. Help me. Real had it.
Let go, said Conrad. Start crawling. But the grip only grew tighter. 5-0 was whimpering like a baby. Like a baby. Conrad managed to snake his arm behind him until he found 5-0's face, which was mashed against his legs. He stroked his cheek, just as if he were his child, and said softly,
5-0, I'm with you. And you're with me, and we're gonna get out of here now. You hear me? We're gonna get out, 5-0, and I'm gonna be with you. You're gonna be right behind me, and I won't leave you. We're gonna crawl, and so you gotta let go of me and put your hands on the ground. I won't leave you.
He kept stroking his cheek.
Big sighs, moans, coughs, sobs, and the ferocious grip slackened. Okay, 5-0, here we go. It was even harder to snake his hand back from behind him and bring his arm forward again. His shoulder kept wedging against the jagged mass that threatened to entomb them. He began slithering on his belly. There was no way he could lift his back high enough to get to his knees and crawl. The space was terribly narrow. All he could see was the faint lacework of light ahead. 5-0 was right behind him, struggling for breath. Suddenly the earth was wet beneath his hands and forearms. Muck. Water streaming in from somewhere. The earth they crawled through was mud. Now he was near enough to the ghostly light to see a small, irregular opening, where a floor had heaved up beneath a wall and torn away from it. He could see the silhouette of an old-fashioned plaster lathing in the breach, an ungodly mass of earth, concrete, and debris above him. He kept inching forward. A section of wire lathing hung straight down. He put the heel of his right hand against it and pushed with all his might. It bent outward. He was looking up through a fissure, into some sort of room. In a phosphorescent gloaming, he could see a row of windows in a wall, but the wall had keeled over at an extraordinary angle, almost 45 degrees. It had torn away from the ceiling, which was itself ruptured and pitched downward in a precarious way. The wall seemed to be suspended by the electrical cables buried in it. Then he realized what it was. The pod's visiting area. The windows were the Lexan windows through which he had talked to Jill on the telephone. The ghostly light was moonlight from the doorway that led out to the dusty yard where the visitors lined up. Somewhere outside, an unmuffled motor was throbbing away, creating a terrific racket. He could hear shouts, screams, cries for help. His lungs and his throat were burning. Could he possibly squeeze through the opening? Was it even 6 inches top to bottom? By shoving his elbows back against the sides of the crevice he was in, he managed to get his head up and through. By twisting sideways, he got his shoulders through. Every time he took a breath, the expansion of his rib cage pinned his arms against his sides. The wire lathing was digging into his back. It was the visitor's area, all right. In the silvery light, he could make out the stainless steel stools, still bolted to the concrete floor, which had pitched up at a bizarre angle. The telephones, jolted out of their cradles, hung down by their cords from the windows. He dug his bare feet into the earth and thrust his body upward with all the power of his legs. A sharp pain. But his right elbow was through the opening, and from that point he was able to wriggle the rest of his body through. He remained on all fours, trying to regain his breath. The floor was tilted at a disorienting angle, mud all over his body. His belly, his face, his nostrils, his eyelashes. Gobs of it fell from his nose and his forehead. There was a raw, burning sensation high up in the small of his back. He contorted his left arm behind him and reached up. Blood. Blood and muscle. Wildly he looked about. A strange, moonlit gloaming. This place, the visitor's area, looked as if a gigantic pair of hands had picked it up, buckled it, wrenched it, and then slammed it down on the earth. No two planes were any longer at right angles. The floor had heaved up, pulling away from the rear wall and leaving the opening he had just come through. The barn-like entrance door had been sprung clean out of its tracks and lay cracked almost in two on the ground outside, allowing the moonlight in. The wall with the Lexan windows had not only torn loose from the ceiling above, but also from the far wall, creating a big V-shaped opening. An opening. an opening. A rage to flee surged through his nervous system. His every synapse, from head to toe, now transmitted the horrible news, understood only by those creatures who have floundered atop a major tremor of the earth. The one constant, the one dependable fundamental of life, namely, the solidity of the earth under your feet. Just an illusion. A sham. Terra firma, what a terrible joke. It moves. It writhes. It bucks. It rises up in thunder. It swallows you. Buries you alive. And it will move again. Soon. Flee! Then, almost at once, a revelation. Zeus.
Conrad. Brother, no leave me.
Conrad spun about. Five-O's eyes were at the opening, pleading. But the big Hawaiian could never make it through that little opening. And if I stay here and try to help him... Five-O, said Conrad. He paused. He wrestled with the implacable giant claustrophobia.
Zeus, I'm not leaving you. I've just got to get you something. Brother.
Conrad looked about the wreckage of the space. Up there, he could make out a length of broken riser pipe. He had to climb up the slope of the concrete floor to get it. It sloped. The entire room, the entire structure, could collapse at any moment. Flee! He was hyperventilating again, just as if he were still trapped underground. He fought himself, fought himself, fought himself.
No, leave me, brother!
And finally retrieved the pipe and came back down the slope in a wary crouch and brought it to the opening.
You gotta pull back, Five-O, so I can stick this thing in there. I gotta make the opening bigger. No, brother!
The eyes looked up at him hopelessly, from out of a dark hole. But then he pulled back. Conrad jammed the pipe into the opening and tried to use it as a lever. He couldn't budge the wall. But little by little, he was able to make the concrete of the floor crumble until the opening was a few inches deeper.
Okay, Five-O. We're gonna try it now. Put your head through.
At first, nothing. Then the stricken face appeared. Five-O was covered in mud. His skin, his hair, his mustache. Streaks, gobs, smears of mud. His eyes looked like two frantic little white organisms trapped in the muck. He was breathing with rapid, shallow gasps. He worked his head through the opening.
Okay, Five-O, now push!
Panting with a rumble that came from deep in his chest, Five-O managed to force his shoulders through. But now he was stuck, just as Conrad had been.
Brother! Brother!
He was breathing with desperate heaves, and his eyes were fastened upon Conrad, begging, begging, begging.
You gotta use your legs, Five-O. You gotta push. You gotta kick. I did it. You can do it.
More desperate heaves. And Five-O managed to get enough of his body through to free his arms.
Push! Push!
The lathing dug into his broad back, but Five-O finally made it through, whereupon he flopped face down on the sloping concrete floor, desperately trying to regain his breath. There were long cuts on his back, smears of blood. The loud motor, whatever it was still grinding away. Agonized cries rose from the interior of West Greystone and beyond. All at once, a shuddering thunder. Tons of structure collapsed right behind them, down onto the crevice they had just crawled through. The wall buckled. The ceiling canted with a tremendous groan. The opening Five-O had just struggled through no longer existed.
Come on, Five-O, get up. We gotta get out of here.
At that instant he understood with the sharpest clarity. This was Zeus' handiwork. Five-O rolled over on his side. His mouth was wide open, and his body was glossy with sweat and blood in the moonlight that came through the doorway. He looked up at Conrad,
but he was breathing so hard he couldn't speak. Conrad took his hand and pulled him to a seated position and finally managed to get him to his feet.
"Put your arm around my shoulders."
He did so, and Conrad steadied him and led him down the slope of the floor. His arm around Five-O's waist, he helped him through the V-shaped opening. His arm was covered with blood, the blood that was streaming down Five-O's back. Both of them were smeared in mud, naked except for their shorts, which the mud had plastered to their bodies. Five-O's mouth remained wide open. He was fighting for breath. They emerged through the big doorway, into the jail yard. Conrad was staggering under Five-O's weight. And finally, Five-O sank helplessly to the ground.
"No, it will move again."
But Conrad managed to say nothing. Five-O was slumped over in a heap, neither sitting nor lying, breathing with a deep, rasping sound. A three-quarter moon was high in the south, over Pleasanton. The sky was bursting with stars.
Stars!
This was the first time he had seen the open sky since he had been in Santa Rita.
Zeus, stars!
It suddenly became so sharply clear. The grinding motor was louder than ever. Barely 30 yards away, on the stomped earth of the jail yard, was a shed-like building. A weak light shone from its windows. The noise came from a gasoline-powered emergency generator. Two beams of light emerged from the shed and came bouncing across the yard. Deputies with flashlights. In the distance, from Pleasanton most likely, came the woo-woo-woo-woo of police car sirens and the klaxon horn of a fire engine. Conrad looked back toward the doorway they had just emerged from. The entire west graystone building had been thrust upward on one side. Its big tar and gravel clerestory roof had cracked down the middle and was canted up at a bizarre angle. And now, for the first time, in the moonlight, Conrad saw the little cliff, the escarpment. A low but sheer cliff, 3 or 4 feet high, had heaved up out of the earth. It ran under the building, under D-pod, and straight through the grounds of the jail on a north-south axis. Conrad gazed beyond. The vast plain of the Livermore Valley, suddenly so clear and peaceful. He looked to the south, toward Highway 580. No sign of it. No lights. Electricity was knocked out everywhere. In the jail yard, more beams, flashlights, danced this way and that. Men were shouting. Without looking up, Five-O said,
"I real had it. Ass out, brudder."
"Just hang on," said Conrad. A beam of light came lurching and bouncing toward them. Then it hit them head on. The light was so powerful, Conrad covered his eyes with his hand. He couldn't even make out the shape of the person holding it.
"Where'd you come from? What's your unit?"
It was an Okie voice, a Livermore Valley farm boy voice. "In there," said Conrad, motioning toward the caved-in building. "D-pod."
"Well, get moving," said the voice behind the flashlight. "You guys are all going in the repair shed."
Five-O didn't budge. In the harsh light of the flashlight, sitting on the ground, slumped over the way he was, almost naked, smeared from head to toe in mud and blood, he looked as if he were about to die. His head hung over on his chest and rose and fell with his labored breathing. "Get up," said the man with the flashlight, but not very forcefully.
"He needs a doctor," said Conrad.
"Yeah, well..."
Just then a voice from nearby began yelling.
"Yo, Leon, where you at?"
"Over here," said the man with the flashlight.
"Got two inmates."
"Never mind that. Come back here. Need you at East Greystone."
The flashlight beam lingered on Five-O and then hit Conrad in the face.
You're going to stay right here, you understand? I'm coming right back, and you guys ain't going to move one fucking inch. Anybody caught heading for the perimeter is going to get shot. Anybody goes near the fence, his ass... out. Whereupon he hurried off at a jog. 5-0, still sitting, turned and supported himself on his right arm and looked at Conrad.
"Conrad, brother,"
he continued to struggle for breath.
"Baggett, Baggett."
"Baggett?"
"Run, brah. Split."
"Split?"
"They going put all the inmates in the shed, in the dark, all them together. Rotto them, they going kill you, brah. Muck ain't I dead?"
Conrad could hear the generator throbbing away. There were cries and shouts. Rods of light from flashlights bounced around in the dark. Conrad got down on his haunches so that his head was level with 5-0's. "I'm going to bag it, 5-0, but not because I'm afraid of Rotto and them. Look." He made a sweeping gesture with his hand to indicate the devastation. "You know who did all this?" He caught himself. He remained there on his haunches, his mouth half open, staring at 5-0, not uttering a sound. He knew it would be pointless to bring up the name of Zeus,